listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The surprise announcement by President Trump that he intends to pull all U.S. troops out of Syria was followed by his musings about doing the same, perhaps, in Afghanistan. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia Friday. President Trump has decided that he's pulling out of Syria, and he's making noise that he's pulling out of Afghanistan. It's like poking the Democrats in the eye to say these things. All of a sudden, there's a mad dog on their team, Mattis, resigned in principle over this with a two-page letter that details at least the fact that there's severe policy disagreements between himself and the president in the context of all the stuff we read. You know, we can, you know, fathom what those conflicts are about. And Trump is making, you know, a sharp turn towards the policies that he promised when he was running, more or less. And that you know, we've been saying since the media and everybody started piling on Trump that this was really the big sin that he had committed that made him, you know, persona non grata among the elite, which was turning his back on the neocon project and looking for detente with Russia and China.
Yeah. Well, I guess we could begin with acknowledging that this is perhaps the greatest political crisis in the history of the United States. Mm-hmm. And that includes the one that led to the Civil War. And the reason I say that is because, in actuality, the deep state, with all that that means and the institutions and interests that define it, is attacking the president of the United States.
Yep.
And if you read or listen to the media this morning, it's almost an open discussion of coup d'etat. I mean, they've almost moved beyond impeachment to now talking about a coup d'etat.
Yep.
And what is it about? It's about what we have been talking about for almost 3 years, yep. Imperial retreat.
Right.
And and I guess the last straw was his saying that the troops in Syria and now Afghanistan should be withdrawn. And as the president in a country that has over the last 50 years given the president almost unquestioned authority in foreign and military policy, he can do that without going to the Senate. And so he's talking about a withdrawal from Syria and Afghanistan.
Right.
Now, this withdrawal from Syria of what is, in effect, an expeditionary force is not a minor thing, because those forces were there as a statement to Russia, Turkey, and Iran, that no matter what was decided in terms of defending the sovereignty of Syria, that the United States would remain and have a military force there, which would in effect be saying that Syria cannot be sovereign without our approval.
Right.
And now they're being withdrawn. Now, this has a lot of meaning. That's why they keep talking about the Kurds, the Syrian Kurds. Well, the fact is that the Syrian Kurds were not really fighting so-called ISIS. The Syrian Kurds were being trained as a strike force to overthrow the Turkish government.
Right.
And this would be a kind of a replay of the coup attempt in 2016. And that's why Erdogan and the Turkish government is so intent upon defeating this Kurdish army on its borders.
Right.
It is not to establish a Kurdistan in Syria as such, but to overthrow the Erdogan government, or to establish a so-called liberated Kurdish zone in that part of Turkey,
right,
that borders Syria. The other thing about this is that the force that has been shepherding Syria towards peace and the reconstitution of its nation and the government and state of Syria has been this alliance of Turkey, Russia, and Iran.
Right.
And I would say, finally, the withdrawal from Syria is conceding, first of all, that the government of Syria, the Assad government, is the legitimate government of the country, that its allies, especially Russia, but also Iran, are allies of a legitimate government. And Syria has the right to ask for help, assistance, even military assistance from its allies. It is a recognition of that. The other thing is that the negotiations in with the Taliban and others over what will be the outcome in Afghanistan, that is, how the U.S. will withdraw, what will be the process of withdrawal, and what will be the process of the establishment of a sovereign Afghan government. These talks are going forward. Trump's announcement that half of the expeditionary force is going to be withdrawn is an indication that those talks have been productive thus far and are going forward. And the Trump, and I don't, you say the Trump administration, whatever the Trump administration is, and a lot of times it looks like Trump alone, has decided that after 17, going on 18 years of war in Afghanistan, that it's time to get out.
Yeah, I mean, you could say even after 42 years, going back to 1977 when you had Brzezinski and his tank over there egging on the very first fighters against the Soviet Union and the legitimate Afghan government at that time. But certainly, yes, since October of 2001. Mm-hmm. You know, yesterday, I'm talking Thursday, the 20th of December, at the UN Security Council, Stefan de Mistura, who is the special envoy to Syria from the UN, made a report about a meeting he had just had with the foreign ministers of Russia, Iran, and Turkey on the question, with also the Syrian government, on the question of negotiating a new Syrian constitution. And and that apparently there's been an accord reached among the parties on this thing. Most particularly, you know, interesting here, of course, is Iran and Turkey being on the same page with the government, by the way. You know, Russia acting more as a guarantor of whatever the parties decide. And it was a very congenial Security Council meeting. The de Mistura's report lasted about 30 minutes. It's his last report. He's given up the office effective January 6th, I think. And he's hoping to have this well underway at that point before he hands over the reins next month. Now, you know, that kind of frames the announcement of President Trump that the U.S. is pulling out. It seems that there has been an agreement reached among all of the parties to the satisfaction of both the local parties and the U.S. government, at least the Trump administration or President Trump. So that is kind of the background to Syria. The reason that he's announcing he won, because that's how they do that. But in fact, he did win. His adversary wasn't ISIS. His adversary was the Pentagon and the CIA. Absolutely. And they're much bigger fish, and that's who he beat so far. So
yeah, that's a great way to put it. And in fact, to understand the political crisis domestically, you have to connect it to these geostrategic moves by Trump.
Yep.
This imperial retreat, and how that is reverberating through the institutions of power and the institutions of the military. This is, I don't know, you know, as we've talked before, how does Trump survive this?
I know.
I mean, on the one side, he still has strong backing from the American electorate. It is in the 40 percentage points.
Yep.
And that is not insignificant going forward, and given all that has been thrown at him.
Right.
But a president has never been able to survive this in the past, but maybe he will.
Well, he's a different kind of creature. There's a few things. First of all, whatever that number is, you know, again, depending on the poll, we've mentioned this before, it runs from about 38 to 51%, but it's in the 40s most likely. Whatever it is, it hasn't budged downward in the whole time he's been in office, and that in the face of a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week onslaught from the media that has unprecedented in human history, this propaganda effort, really, literally. You know, I'm thinking back to, you know, different times when the media went, you know, bananas on somebody like Gary Hart, or after they staked him out and they started beating on him, or what was his name from Vermont that was the presumptive nominee for a minute in 2004?
Howard Dean.
He ended up, Howard Dean. And, Howard Dean looked like, after 2 days of, you know, being abused in the press, like he was going to jump off a bridge or something. And Trump, for him, I see him saying, I got 43% of the American public loves me. I'm going to sell each one of them a T-shirt and make a killing, you know. And that's just the way he sees the world, I guess. But the thing that really the battle that's been won here, to the extent that, you know, there's any conclusion to any of this yet, is that the battle between he and the deep state over what's going to happen in Syria appears to have been settled in his favor.
Yeah. I think you're right, Don. And what they're doing, who has ever seen anything like this? I mean, they're openly discussing not only impeachment, but the removal from office.
Yep.
And if it can't go through the normal legal channels, they're talking about other ways of removing him.
Again.
There's even some insistence on MSNBC that the military act responsibly and remove him from office in defense of the national interests and the security of the nation. I mean, this is...
Yeah, look at Foreign Affairs today. The top story today, Elliot Abrams, remember the convict from Iran-Contra? He got pardoned by Bush, and then he got hired by Bush Jr. But he authors a piece, Trump versus the Government, Can America Get His Story Straight? And at the very beginning, guess who he invokes? He says, as a parallel, he says, as the diplomat Charles Frankel recalled in his memoir, a White House visitor once presented a proposal to President John F. Kennedy. That's a first-rate idea, Kennedy said. Now we must see whether we can get the government to accept it. Well, we know how that turned out for him.
Yes.
So, and this is suggested by Elliot Abrams, like at the top of Foreign Affairs today. So there's some less cultured, like those that write editorials for the New York Times and short stories for the New York Times Book Review that we've seen over the months already, where they just talk about out and out shooting them.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, we've heard this talk from the time he was elected, from 2016.
Yep.
That's right. And so the question is how the nation will move forward and what will the masses of people do in the presence of these threats to an elected president. I mean, they're actually saying in the name of democracy that we're going to overturn the election. And I heard Michael Moore, who was going completely nuts, say that he was not elected by the people. Well, there is such a thing called the Electoral College, and every other president that got the majority of the electoral votes became president. Yeah. But suddenly, because he didn't get the majority of the popular vote, he is not a legitimate president, according to Michael Moore.
Right.
That talk is only talk that only encourages coup d'etat and a shutdown of any capacity of the government to function and for Trump to govern. And they're saying this in the face of the polls that say that the numbers pretty much that elected him are still with him.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and this is something that, you know, I'm looking at. They're trying to farm what used to be, in any event, the presumed mindset of Republican voters, of Trump voters over foreign policy, that they are, you know, right-wing, war-favoring, troop-supporting, mindless, you know, militarists. And we saw that wasn't the case at all, that one of the things that distinguished Trump from the other other Republicans that were running and from the Republican establishment that was really favorably received by the Republicans at the RNC was his call to end the regime change and nation building and war and all of that stuff and to instead focus on job creation and building the economy. And because it's clear from the way he was framing NATO, our relations with Japan and South Korea, the whole situation in Korea, that one of the biggest problems that he's had with the entire foreign policy alignment of the United States is that it costs too damn much.
Well, that's the big thing.
And so this is what you talk about, imperial retreat.
And was becoming increasingly ineffective.
It's ineffective and it's burdensome and it's a drain on the economy. Every economist knows this, that speaks honestly about it, unless they're in the employ of one of the corporations that make money on this, you know, military, you know, Northrop or, you know, whatever. But no one speaks about it publicly. Well, Trump is not only was speaking about it, but saying we're going to change policy. Mm-hmm. Again, that was the big thing at the very beginning when he started talking outside the box about NATO, that they went, it was like you poked the whole media in the eye.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, Don, we have just talked about this so much that we're almost blue in the face. And I guess the both of us have been hoping that somewhere down the line, somebody was listening and that those who might be listening might might be prepared to go out among the people and develop a genuine peace movement that was self-determining and rooted organically among working people and reflected their interests. Peace is pro-people, pro-justice. Right. War is the enemy of the right. people, the enemy of the poor. And that's what we've been trying to say. You overturn this election, what are you back to? A Hillary Clinton or Hillary Clinton type with the policies right. of no-fly zone over Syria, pushing harder for military confrontation over Ukraine with Russia? Is that what we want? A no deal towards establishing relations with North Korea that respected the nation's sovereignty? I mean, what do you want? I mean, what should a peace movement want at this time? The American people, in large majorities, have said that they don't want to study war anymore. I mean, if that's yep. the case, how do we account for this small, narrow, and quite putrid peace movement? You know, I mean, it makes no sense.
One of the things that, I mean, we've seen this with respect to Trump all the way through, no matter what he does or happens around him, if he touched buildings and they turned to gold and the gold was distributed among the people, before anyone could say this was a good thing, they'd have to say, you know, I'm no fan of Trump's, but, you know, mm-hmm. you have mm-hmm. to qualify it. So, which is unusual because, yeah. for example, people don't do that with the Clintons, despite the you know, odious things that they've done. But when you see the, you know, the bill that they put together that was really his initiative, undoing a lot of the worst offenses of mass incarceration and the sentencing and all of that stuff. Anyone that said anything about it, has that preamble to it, and, mm-hmm. And so I posted something on my Facebook page yesterday, saying in essence, okay, so Trump pulls out of Syria. Let's say he pulls out of also Afghanistan, like he's threatening, makes a peace treaty in Korea, makes peace with Russia and China, brings home the troops from all around the world, and closes the bases around the world.
Mm-hmm.
How many and then the deep state moves against him. How many of you people might, you know, people that 5,000 whatever friends that I got, how many of you people would stand up to defend him in that circumstance?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
And you know what? So far, nobody said me.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you look at the American people, a lot of them in the face of this, there's a lot of fear. People are afraid. The other thing is that people are ill-informed. And I guess the third thing is there is no leadership on questions of peace and social and economic justice. In some ways, it looks like this crisis is long-term, and we might enter a period of long-term political crisis and back and forth and unresolved problems of political and foreign policy. And then the hammer drops, an economic recession,
right?
Which could be a game changer. Who knows?
Right. And you know, there's that's multi-tiered also.
Yeah.
Because you have, you know, what people refer to as, you know, recession, depression, mm-hmm. they make reference to the markets, particularly to the stock markets.
Yeah.
And yeah. what's happening, there's some fundamental things that are happening with the economy that are sort of not really measured there yet.
Yeah.
You know, they're bringing back jobs, you know, manufacturing jobs, and just the whole attempt to reposition the U.S. economy against some of the other larger economies globally, and the U.S. workers against other workers that have been, you know, weaponized against the U.S. workers. Those things might bring benefits to workers here economically, while the stock market is dipping. And so technically, we might be in a recession while people's real incomes are climbing. I mean, there's some contradictions that are possible in the middle of all of the moving parts that are in motion right now. So I don't know, but you're right. Look, tomorrow, you know, or today, the market dumps out and, you know, we end up in a crisis like we were in 2008. Who knows where that goes? First of all, Trump may not survive that day, because that might be the day they march out of Langley and the Pentagon and shoot him someplace, you know, figuring they got cover to do it. So who knows? But, you know, there are a lot of other variables, too. But to me, it seems that as we see one and another piece, even if it's a simple outlying piece of the architecture of hegemony being dismantled or turned back or, you know, folded up and put in a drawer or something, we ought to be doing everything possible to, A, hand over political rewards as an example to anybody else who's inclined to do that, by the way. Like, you know what? When you do this, you get this. Mm-hmm. Okay? And also, of course, to, you know, more or less encourage further behavior like that in the administration, which is, you know, the thing I think in front of us right now. If he's willing to alienate everybody over these policies, why isn't the anti-war movement willing to stand up and say, that's the right thing to do, thank you?
Well, I think you know the answer to that question. I think, Don, we're at a stage of rebuilding people's movements and rebuilding a genuine left, an anti-war and social justice left, and overcoming all of the problems of sectarianism that is the left. We're at a new stage in history, I think, and how we resolve these contradictions are yet to be seen.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a rough ride for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, for all we know, these contradictions may well end up resolving us.
Right, true that. From our standpoint, we want to be able to resolve them
correct.
In a way that benefits humanity.
Yeah, I'm on that side, yes.
Yes.
Agreed. You know, look at some of the things that, you know, where people actually do some serious analysis of this stuff. And one of the things that I saw was at the Moon Over Alabama website, where they're exploring what some of the geopolitical, you know, contextual things are to a decision by Trump to withdraw these 2,000 troops from Syria. And of course, one of the most important things for them, I mean, you know, I'm not under, in any event, no one should be under the illusion that Trump or anyone else around him intends to end U.S. imperialism, whether they're hostile to it. What they're trying to do is figure out a way to make it maintainable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we got to look at, okay, so does that work on our side or, you know, or against our side? And of course, if it means less war and, you know, a smaller footprint on the necks of people abroad by our military, it's a good thing. So
that's right.
So here, one of the things is that by maintaining the strategy, if you want to call it that, that was followed by the Obama administration and then continued by, you know, Mattis and others into this administration, Turkey is going with Russia. I mean, Turkey's, you know, NATO position, the theory of this piece that I'm looking at Moon Over Alabama is that what Trump sees is that trying to run the whole world by ourselves is too expensive and counterproductive. So let some other guys run that half of the world and we'll run our half, and then we can just sit down and haggle over stuff when it comes up between us. And in that context, Turkey ought to be choosing up sides with Russia and China instead of the United States. And so if you have the United States doing what it's doing in Syria and playing around with Kurds and everything else that, you know, operate against Turkey's national interest. You've had the EU dissing Turkey for, you know, forever, I mean, Turkey's been trying to get into the EU for a very long time, and the Europeans just keep dissing them. And, you know, the U.S. hasn't been treating Turkey very well. You mentioned the other coup attempt, and there's this whole, you know, Kurdish thing that's going on. And so it may well be that by backing out and letting Turkey and Iran and Russia settle this problem, that Trump is saying, okay, let's get down to our fundamental geopolitical interests and not let this little sideshow start a fight that we really don't need.
Well, and Trump also realizes the magnitude of the federal debt of the United States.
Yeah, true that.
Which is larger than the GDP.
Yeah,
and that's right. I mean, it doesn't take rocket science, but it did take a political outsider to acknowledge that these debts, which are in large measure due to past wars and the cost in terms of veterans' health and all of that type of thing, and preparation for future wars.
Yeah.
I mean, the largest area of discretionary funding in the federal budget is the military.
Yep.
And so he understands that when he comes out and says that the military budget is crazy and we're going to reduce it and I want to meet in a summit with Putin and Xi Jinping to work out some of these military and political strategic questions, I mean, I think you got to take it seriously.
Yep.
I mean, he doesn't have to say it. He could just go along to get along.
And I think in that context also, and we're kind of at the end here, but I think just to conclude this, in that same very same context, it's noteworthy that the first audit of the Pentagon that comes back saying, you know what, they've got trillions of dollars that no one knows where it went, and it's completely unauditable. The entire thing is so opaque that it's impossible to figure out what goes on there, and there's a fundamental change that has to happen. I don't think it's a coincidence that we're hearing this and seeing this audit and the report of the audit, more importantly, happen under Trump's watch. So we'll pick up there next week, Tony, and I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you very much, Don.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has declared multilateralism in international affairs a failure. What is needed, according to him, is a new liberal order led by the United States. Such an order calls into question some important issues. Does this mean the universalization of American law and limited sovereignty for the rest of the world? Crosstalking Pax Americana, I'm joined by my guest, James Jatris in Washington. He's a former U.S. diplomat and former advisor to the U.S. Senate Republican leadership. In New York, we have Daniel Lazar. He's an author and freelance journalist who writes frequently about the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the U.S. Constitution. And in Madrid, we cross to Manuel Lopez Linares. He is the author of Pax Americana, and he's a university lecturer as well as a contributor at Expansion. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Jim, let me go to you first in Washington. I thought we already had Pax Americana. That's why I'm calling this program Pax Americana 2.0, because it seems like Mr. Pompeo has some interesting ideas. Presenting it to the to international diplomats at the U.S. Marshall Fund, I thought it was quite interesting, their reaction. It was really quite tepid. It was kind of very quiet clapping here. It just looks like unilateralism to me, and I thought the U.S. created multilateral organizations after the Second World War to create a more stable order. It seems now, get rid of the U.N., the walk away from the Paris climate deal, which I don't have a problem with, the International Court of Justice. I could go on and on about all of these relationships and agreements. How does walking away from all of them and more make it safer for the world, including the United States. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, it doesn't make it safer. And I think the problem is less unilateralism per se, but this defiance for the rule of law, not only internationally, but even our own constitution. I think Mr. Pompeo's speech was a triumph of misdirection, that it was essentially old neoconservative wine poured into an America First rhetorical bottle. It was Woodrow Wilson masquerading as Pat Buchanan. I think he or his speechwriter was trying to give the impression this is what Mr. Trump promised in 2016. What he's really giving us is what has been destroying America and the world for the last 30 years, where we get to be the uber sovereign over the entire planet and tell everybody else to do, but we don't actually look out for our own narrow national interests. I mean, we can send troops illegally to Syria, but we can't send them to our own border to defend that.
Good point. Daniel, is this the universalization of American law? Because, I mean, we have this situation with a Chinese national that was detained in Canada, Huawei, the Chinese company here. As we're sitting down here, I read that a former Canadian diplomat has been detained in China. So now the game begins here. I don't understand how unilateralism makes America stronger. It seems to me the U.S. is isolating itself more and more from the world.
Yeah, I agree with that. The paradox is that Pompeo is making a bid for unilateralism precisely at the moment when U.S. foreign policy is falling apart. I mean, the U.S. foreign policy is in disarray in Afghanistan, Syria, Saudi Arabia, where the U.S. is a real disaster on its hands with Mohammed bin Salman, and the Ukraine, where essentially Putin has smartly wrapped America's knuckles over the Kerch Strait. So America is actually doing very poorly. But as its performance declines, its rhetoric seems to soar. So now it's talking about imposing American diktat on the entire world. It makes no sense. It's actually quite laughable.
You know, Manuel, in looking at Pompeo's speech, the first thing that came to my mind is, well, what happens if other countries disagree with this unilateralism? What happens when China says no? Russia says no. Iran says no. Even EU says no. I mean, Pompeo didn't seem to really address that, just assuming that everyone is going to agree to American unilateralism. I thought it was a very bizarre speech. Go ahead in Madrid.
Well, I don't think that he was speaking absolutely in terms of unilateralism, back to unilateralism. I think he tried to calm European allies up here, down here. He tried to calm us here because obviously the new policy from a U.S. president is different from the rest, at least since World War II. So basically, instead of having the liberal world order in place as usual, which has been, in my opinion, in general terms, widely beneficial for the world in general terms, even though we can find exceptions, obviously. But instead of following the same procedures as the other presidents, what Mike Pompeo was trying to say is that, yes, we have a president who is a Jacksonian tradition, who is wants to forget about the world only when he's very much interested and he's going to be very rough. But calm down, don't worry, all his talk about NATO, etc., because we're going to try to keep in place this liberal world order. We're going to keep in place Pax Americana, but we're just going to try to combine it with America First. And I think that combination, I agree in that part, which I also think it is impossible or very difficult to mix. And that's the reason why Europeans here in Germany just basically were not very enthusiastic about. And with regards to your question, what is going to happen? Well, if they pull out and they go back to unilateralism, well, I think the rest of the countries, the rest of the world already see that. So we're just getting into a more, say, dangerous world because we go back to before World War II, where we had unilateralism, bilateral deals, retreat of America from the world, and also basically going back to, instead of multilateralism and collective security concepts, going back to balance
but
of power
we're
politics.
Going, okay, if we're going back to before the Second World War, well, what brought about the Second World War? I think, you know, history tells us a lot of things there. Jim, it seems to me that, you know, Pompeo wants to live in a world where the United States determines the geopolitical interests of just about everyone, and to determine what countries, what kind of friendships other countries can have with other countries. Okay, for example, the relationship that Iran has with Syria, that's verboten in the Pompeo world. But I mean, they're two sovereign countries; they decide to cooperate. I mean, that's how we see international law. I worry that international law itself is going to be dispensed with, and you'll just have an American universalized diktat of what is legal and what isn't legal. And of course, it'll be legal to the advantage of one country. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I would agree with everything you said except for the very last part, the advantage of one country. I don't think it's to the advantage of the United States at all.
No, okay, the perception. No, I agree. The perception that it would be to their advantage. Yeah. Go ahead. Good point. Go ahead.
Exactly.
Keep going, Jim.
That's right. In other words, that this quest for global domination, and that's what it really amounts to. This will end in war, Peter. This is something that is extremely dangerous. One part of Mr. Pompeo's speech really struck me when he talked about sovereignty for ourselves and for our friends.
Friends.
But that means, I guess, we have the unilateral right to say what other countries' sovereignty should be abridged, not because they violated any internationally agreed upon or binding rule, but because we say so. In other words, we have a situation where we're not only one of the players on the international stage, we also get to be the referee and the umpire, and if need be, the executioner. And this cannot end well, Peter, that we cannot continue to divide the world into satellites and vassals on the one side and enemies on the other side, especially when we're lining up with not only Iran, but Russia and China as potential enemies. Remember, there was a recent report by a congressionally mandated commission saying that not only might there be a war with Russia or China, we could lose that war. The unthinkable for 40 years during the old Cold War has now become thinkable because of this mindset.
You know, Daniel, going back to Mike Pompeo, I mean, in looking what you know, hasn't been on the job 9 months he's been on the job right now. He's probably the most undiplomatic Secretary of State the United States has ever had. I mean, he never talks about diplomacy, and he hates awkward questions that is at odds with his vision, which I'm not particularly sure I understand it completely because it doesn't make any sense logically. But I mean, diplomacy isn't the Secretary of State's strong card, is it?
No, not at all. This administration thoroughly rejects diplomacy in any shape, form, or whatsoever. But the important thing is that the U.S. foreign policy is doing very poorly. The U.S. is struggling on multiple fronts. It's just overstretched. Vis-a-vis China and Russia. It's completely isolated on Iran, except for Saudi Arabia and Israel. No one's lining up behind the U.S. policy there. So America is proclaiming its global sovereignty at a time when its power is increasingly in trouble.
Okay. Manuel, speaking as a European, do you think that Washington should dictate European security, energy security policy, like demanding that Europeans not buy Russian natural gas?
Well, I think those comments some time ago with Angela Merkel were very inappropriate because obviously we that's kind of unthinkable, no? That the U.S. president would get into those kind of issues. And besides that, that kind of thing was not a problem to any other former U.S. presidents. But having said that, it is so unthinkable, so strange for him to say that it seems to me that it could be a little bit of politics here and there. He's always on campaign. He has this Russian collusion thing behind, and there might be something, obviously. There's a lot of information out there. So he might be playing a little bit now that he's being tough, rougher than ever Russia.
I think it's also that he wants the Europeans to buy American natural gas through LNG. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Pax Americana. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Let me go back to Jim in Washington. Jim, you said in a previous comment that it was the U.S. would pursue its own interest, and it's the American allies that it were aligned with American interests. But as I mentioned at the end of the first part of the program, the energy policy, there's beginning to be a big divergence. And if the Europeans don't fall in line, they're going to be punished, okay? When you look at the sanction warnings about buying Iranian energy, there were a lot of countries that got dispensations, but not really the Europeans. I mean, Donald Trump, because I'm for the complete breakup of NATO and a new security architecture for Europe. I think it's way overdue. But, you know, Donald Trump with this rhetoric coming from his Secretary of State, well, that's just hastening it. It's just bringing it closer to fruition, which I'm actually quite happy about. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, let me throw a little curveball here, Peter, is that the suggestion has been made that Donald Trump is really playing four-dimensional chess here. By putting all these neocons in his administration, he is deliberately breaking down all of the things that bind us to these other countries, breaking down the liberal international order by pretending to uphold it, but then failing in doing that. I don't buy any of this, I must say, but some people have this theory. Look, when President Macron of France said, oh, we want to have our own European army, which is a silly idea because Europe really doesn't have any external security threats, you'd think an America First president would say, hey, great, little Macron, that's great. You have your army, we'll get out of NATO, see you around, you have fun over there. Instead, he threatens him. Now, maybe, you know, some people look at pulling out of the INF agreement, as you say, threatening them over energy security. Maybe at some point the Europeans grow a pair and say, we've had enough, and break away, and would accomplish just what you were talking about. I don't see that happening, though. I think one of the problems is the European leaders are so weak, so worthless, so willing to be dictated to, that there's no limit to how much they will actually crawl when Washington barks.
You know, Daniel, in a way, the more that the Trump administration bullies, and I think that's an appropriate word, bullies, its European allies, the more that instability that we see, I'm thinking of France right now, the usual two years of nonsense called Brexit. I mean, this should give a lot of Europeans pause about maybe trying to go their own way much more so. I mean, the United States, it's either our way or the highway. Maybe they will start reconsidering some of their policies. And I'm obviously thinking about Russia at this point. We, of course, have these machinations going on in Ukraine, which, unfortunately, the Trump administration continues to support. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I think that James, though, is correct. I mean, I think the Europeans are in such disarray as well these days. They're just too weak to oppose Trump. Trump is weak also, but the Europeans for the moment seem to be even weaker. So it's a kind of a battle of the weak. And it's very hard to establish any kind of broader leadership in this increasingly chaotic environment we find ourselves in. But, you know, but that said, but trouble is breaking out all over the place, and especially the Iranian situation, Iran and Syria and Israel and Saudi Arabia is increasingly dangerous. But also the U.S. seems intent on pouring oil on the fire.
You know, Manuel, you know, Iran was just mentioned right here. And you've written a book about Pax Americana. I mean, I understood the post World War II order that was created by the United States. I understand the intent behind it in the context of the Cold War. But after the Cold War and the rise of this kind of neocon ideology, I mean, a sane person wouldn't say, focus all of American foreign policy on Iran. I mean, that's obviously politics going on there. And also, if you look at some of the issues that the U.S. is intruding upon on the Korean Peninsula, I mean, the Koreans are actually making some progress moving towards peace there, but the U.S. is dragging its feet, and it is planning, it's seemingly so, planning a war against Iran. How is that possibly in the interest of anyone, including Americans?
Well, it's very difficult to understand. That's why I sometimes say that the only explanation possible is that some people in the administration are very much influenced by people that have an outlook which is very far away from the Western outlook, which is very dualistic, Manichaean, and it comes from a very dualistic view of the world, which has some apocalyptic connotations. Yeah. Some of the advisors and even Mike Pompeo himself is thinking that if things get worse, it's okay, because in the Middle East, there's going to something is going to happen called Armageddon, and everything is going to be fine after that. So if we mess the whole thing up, nothing is going to happen. I find that explanation quite plausible, because otherwise you wouldn't understand what happened with Bush and Iraq in 2003 and some other presidents. I mean, and it's a total opposite vision to what Barack Obama or even Bill Clinton and even George Herbert Walker Bush, who died recently, had to do with. I mean, it's an opposite vision. It's opposite to the Western values and to the Western outlook, and it has absolute nonsense. But the thing is, in order to understand it, I think you have to put yourself in his shoes, in his feet, and understand that they have a very different outlook that has to do with that. It has to do with prophecies on the future.
It's very interesting. You know, Jim, it seems to me, Daniel's already mentioned on this program, is that on so many different levels and dimensions, American foreign policy is very chaotic right now. There's no rhyme or reason to it that I can see. But one thing I think Pompeo and his ilk are responding to is the unipolar moment is either already over or it's rapidly coming to an end. And I think that explains this sudden reaction, you know, with all these posture reports about picking enemies, preparing for conflict and all, because the unipolar moment was supposed to last forever. It was the new radiant future. No, it has come to, it's coming to a close, and the U.S. Is lashing out because it feels that its hegemonic moment is evaporating before its eyes. Go ahead, Jim.
You mean the 1,000-year unipolar moment isn't going to last that long? Look, I agree with that, Peter, and I think part of the problem is that we're not looking at a pre-World War II situation. We're looking at a pre-World War I situation. That the United States insists, and when I say United States, I mean this really bad foreign policy team that Mr. Trump has assembled, if they insist on trying to perpetuate a unipolar moment, global hegemony that is visibly failing, instead of coming to terms with the other rising powers, particularly Russia and China, to maybe some extent with India, to come up with a stable concert of powers, understood spheres of influence where we don't clash, we stay out of each other's business, we stay out of each other's face. Unless that happens relatively soon, something very, very bad is going to happen. And I think right now, the top contender for that is Ukraine, where Mr. Poroshenko, because of his dismal reelection bid, is staging the provocations like he did in the Kerch Strait. He's going after churches and monasteries in Ukraine, which is going to result in violence. And I think Russia may have to respond. Things are going to get very ugly fairly soon. We don't know where or how, unless somehow we pull back from trying to maintain a global dominance that simply cannot be continued.
You know, Daniel, and I look at all of us here on this program here, and we're in the same generation, okay? We all brought up, being aware of the possibility of war. The Cold War, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example. And, you know, it seems to me that the policymakers now are not as wary as war as they should be. I mean, now there's a nuclear doctrine where they're conceiving of making small nukes, you know, for a battlefield. I remember in the 1980s, that was scoffed at as total madness. And now we've gone back to it. It seems like these people in power don't understand that how close we can come to a conflict. Because, you know, living here in Russia will do everything to protect its sovereignty. And it's made that clear to everyone. But that's heard on deaf ears by people like Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I agree totally. The abrogation of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty is very dangerous. I mean, the U.S. is walking away from some very important nuclear arms accords that were hammered out in the last years of the Cold War, and now it's just casting them aside. This is amazingly irresponsible, amazingly reckless, but the U.S. is doing it. And it's, I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine what the repercussions will be. But it's important to bear in mind that the old Pax Americana 1.0 is falling apart. Trump has no idea what to replace it with because he's just crazy. But he's reasserting U.S. Unilateralism at a time when the chaos is increasing and the U.S. actually has diminishing power. And I think it's very important to point out what's one country which is pushing bringing things to the breaking point, and that's Israel. I mean, Israel is the major force in Washington. It's very influential in Washington, as we all know, and it is the country which is pushing for a rupture with Iran and pushing for action against Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And essentially, Israel is the one country on earth that America can't say no to. So Israel is kind of calling the shots, and Israel's confrontation with Iran is deepening, and that conflict seems to be unstoppable.
And
many other conflicts.
Right,
as well.
If I can stay with you, we only have a few more seconds left here. Add to that, I'm agreeing with you. One more layer, and the now open alliance that Riyadh has with Tel Aviv, and they are like-minded in their objectives to confront Iran.
Yes, but the Riyadh regime is falling apart before our very eyes. I mean, that regime is in an advanced state of crisis. I don't know what'll replace it in the next year or so. But MBS can't stay in power, and the Al Saud are themselves falling apart. So what's going to happen in Saudi Arabia? I mean, U.S. is relying on Saudi Arabia, but it's the most, it's chosen
okay, well, they've chosen very bad allies in the region. We've run out of time, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, New York, and in Madrid. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.